I am 42, the 29th of April, 1995, to the 28th of April, 1996. Over. Beautiful, just beautiful, by Ade Cartwright. 42, couldn't escape it if I wanted to. Just hit the 6 by 7, and my answer was Tesco. Distracting myself, checking on the plight of the beans. In my previous career, as a showman, my worldwide trips had introduced me to Aldi, a store not as yet of these shores. You could buy a shrink-wrap 4-pack for the price of 1 tin from the essential range in my aisle. I considered for a moment to invest in beans. Would they have a big enough return to support me in years to come? If the Aldi model ever took off, would it mean lower production costs due to volume of numbers, but higher profits due to units shifted? There was a reason I left that aisle. I'd be back later for chicken soup stock. Remember that wee holiday touring the Hebrides I didn't mention? The one that was supposed to be a well-earned break from work to recharge the batteries? That didn't really go to plan. Me and the accomplice got pished. I still can't remember a thing. Gimpo, the other guy who came along with us, was more the accomplice's mate than mine. He recorded whatever and made it into a film. He reminded me of Yozza Hughes, but shorter and grumpier. Really didn't offer them the job either. This guy with a shitty Super 8 said to think of it as a severe, "you've been framed" sort of thing, but didn't invite me to the world premiere. And apparently, I signed a contract handing all the rights, edits and profits over to this guy. All I know is my bank account took a hammering. I was sure I had a couple more zeros when I went on that trip. I definitely had some eyebrows, though. I tried reasoning with the little prick. 1K per venue for each showing pulled, and that's mates rates, was all I got. So I couldn't afford to get legal advice or a restraining order and ended up confused in Tesco's in the wrong aisle contemplating beans while I was supposed to be buying crayons. Felt like pishing in the wind. Moving forward meant protest placards. I'd already scouted out back, plenty of pallets and cardboard wedged in amongst the shopping trolleys for the signs. I'd called on reinforcements, although only the accomplice rocked up. He gave me a heads up that Gimpo was an evil genius type, without being that much of a genius. A time was arranged. Meet at the back of Spar in Corby. If we didn't pay up the fine, folks of Belper would see our shame. The Spar in Corby is where I used to get the bus from with Neville Staples. He was going to name his style of music after the store. I told him to have a rethink. Gimpo turned up, smug as you like, so I knocked him out with an imported shrink wrap 4-pack. The accomplice rolled out of the shop with a bag of marshmallows for the picket line fire and a staple gun asking what I was smirking at. "Gimpo isn't going to be bothering us again and I've got 500 quid. "Whatever," was the reply. He still fired a round of shots into the air from his staple gun. We decided on chips by the sea to celebrate, ending up on Hunstanton's cliffs. I had a boot full of placards just in case someone decided the show must go on. "Gimpo is a fucking cunt," was the best and only one we came up with. But it looked good. neither of us could hold a tune, let alone cobble a song together. So we were going to use a compilation cassette that I'd found sellotaped to my favourite issue of Smash Hits magazine. Pete Burns was on the cover, although it was a shame Morrissey was with him at the photo shoot. At least it wasn't the fucking Thompson twins. Fortunately, it was the best of Stock, Aitken and Waterman 80s protest remixes. The Accomplices' idea. Some of the tracks were very, very dodgy. Maybe we could have done one. I did think it sounded brilliant, though. I clicked off the handbrake, did a dramatic roll out of the car, and watched the bluebird fly off the cliff edge. It flew more like a penguin, but it was a dramatic smash and decent fireball. "What the fuck is going on?" the Accomplice squealed. "My chips were in there." "So were mine, along with Gimpo, who was in the boot," I replied. "So why did I only get 250 quid? "That's Gimpo." The guy with the lazy eye was back. He had the Accomplice's money, and I had a 750 quid suit. Quite fitting to wear, and quite fitting to wear to Gimpo's demise. I couldn't have it on at the chicken shop, though. Standard work uniform only. Had to lead by example. I bought the Kentucky Foundation, as the boxes were a decent colour, and its opposite, KFC, seemed more of a challenge. My options were earn the money via drumsticks to pay the Accomplice or sell the suit back to the lazy eye guy. I thought, fuck it, as it's November the 5th. I just torched the place and claimed the insurance for the suit. All went to plan. The chicken empire burnt. The day after, November the 6th, on BBC One, a film appeared. Seems Gimpo's mate was Kevin Hull, a film director and documentary maker. We really had been had. It wasn't a lazy eye. He had a brick that was perched on a ledge that fell and twatted him in the eye. That's where he got the blank expression on his face. His eye was just sad, not lazy at all. Old Sad Eye was a distraction now. All my documents, including insurance, were in the car. The Kentucky Foundation's fate now lay irrevocably sealed in the imploded remains of Gimpo, nestling amongst the rocks 120 feet below a cliff in Norfolk. Beautiful, just beautiful. Good job I taped the documentary.
Under. Why? By Deborah Key Higgins. May 1995. Ash, ash, ash. My dreams are full of ash. It swirls around me, filling my ears, stuffing itself relentlessly into my nose and packing my mouth with an acrid taste. Cough it out, and each expulsion briefly creates a Rorschach-type image that hangs suspended in front of me before dissipating into the night air. First it is echo from the cover of Crocodiles, but as it falls it rotates slightly and becomes a fish. Not just any fish, not the salmon of Newton Stewart or the brown trout of Muirfad, but I know, as sometimes you know for certain in dreams, it's one of the two fish from the Sea of Tiberias that, along with the 5 loaves, was multiplied and used to feed the hungry crowd on a mountain. The ash billows up, suffocating me once more, and so again I cough. This time out pops the image of an elderflower shrub, but as I attempt to reach out to pick its fragrant flowers, they disappear. and a familiar anxiety bubbles up from a stomach that I am too late to harvest even one soup bowl of the blossom for my father's yearly elderflower wine. And the flowers will never ever die, and the flowers will never die, and autumn in the country cannot withhold the sky, and the flowers will never die. And as I awake, I remember it is not the Brad Pitt look-alike Hermann Rorschach in 1921, but rather the doctor/poet Justinus Kerner in 1857, who first published a book of poems, Klexographien, inspired by inkblots that he believed were not the projections of our own minds, but rather the daguerreotypes of the invisible world. One of the books Dr. Kerner is most famous for, The Seeress of Prevorst, is about Friedrich Hauff, a German mystic and somnambulist who was taken into care by the physician in the last years of her life. In it, Kerner details the premonitory dreams Hauff experienced and how, with the use of his magnetic treatment, he was able to harness her dark subconsciousness to predict the future of the lives of the people around her. August 1995. Preparing to take Gimpo's film on the road. This time my dreams are full of tea. I am walking from the cafe in Safeway, and as I gulp down the brew, my mouth is thick with an impossible amount of tea leaves, which I spit onto the precast concrete flagstone forecourt of Friars Square Shopping Centre, Aylesbury. The tea leaves form the word why, sizzling in the unusually hot August sun, and then a hawk swoops down, first directly into my face, as if it were saying, take that, before turning into a bluebird and diving down to peck angrily at the tea leaf word I've spit onto the ground until it changes the word to stop, before flying away to migrate 180 miles northwest. November 1995. We're no longer talking about the money. For 23 years since we burnt it, at least. The BBC Omnibus documentary will air tomorrow and we'll see out the rest of the scheduled shows, but otherwise all questions will have to be paused mid-frame for 23 years until 2017. Tonight, I dream I am inside a cube. Outside, it is gleaming and perfect, but inside, it's Christmas. And there are all walks of life drinking tenant super, having a party together. I leave through a door and enter a long tunnel. As I walk through the tunnel and around a corner, I can see ahead the exit has a dark pink and exotic flowering rhododendron bush masking the entrance. I peek through to see on the other side a workbench, vise, chisel, saw and hammers, as well as Mr. McQuarter's plane that I begged my parents for when I was 7. The plane is being used to smooth out the leg of a bed, which appears to be some kind of prize. I slip my left hand into the vise and tighten. January 1996. I dream I am in the offices of Martin Green Ravden Accountants, and Lionel Martin is patiently explaining again, as he did in real life earlier that day, the deliberate destruction of money as a statement about art or as a statement about money is not tax deductible. And all appeals have fallen on deaf ears. So, as it is 9 months since we submitted our tax return, that the time has come to pay £330,000. This is particularly galling. We've stripped the K Foundation account and we'll have to come up with this money ourselves. It's one thing to deliberately plan to destroy your own money and quite another to have the Inland Revenue stick their grubby little mitts into our pockets to extract their pound of flesh on top. I come to realise the offices of Martin Green Ravden Accountants is actually a boat. Behind Lionel, I can see Kurtz from Heart of Darkness pointing at the demand letter and whispering, "The horror! The horror!" I look to my left, and Zed looks over towards me and nods. Up front, Gimpo is driving the boat. We pull away, up the Congo, in search of our souls. In yonder mill, I rested and sat me down to look upon the wheel's quick glimmer and on the flowing brook as in a dream. Before me the saw with restless play was cleaving through a fir tree its long and steady way. The tree through all its fibres with living motion stirred, and in a dirge-like murmur these solemn words I heard: "O thou who wanderest hither a timely guest, thou art, for thee this cruel engine is passing through my heart, when soon in earth's still bosom thy hours of rest begin. This wood shall form the chamber whose walls shall close thee in. Four planks I saw and shuddered, dropped in that busy mill. Then, as I tried to answer, at once the wheel was still." Justinus Kerner, translated by William Cullen Bryant.
A Troubled Dream. Dreaming of Car Parks by Richard Bryant. Dreaming of car parks again. I couldn't decide if this was stultifying, a call to action, or a sign of things to come. Every night for 3 weeks now, car parks, all different, often weirdly so, but usually with the same air of foreboding, and often there was another person who was doing something hardly credible in the surroundings. Like many dreams, the details, if they could be said to have details, dissolved on waking, leaving just the mood, the feeling. Some I could remember and wrote down the fragments in a notebook as soon as I woke. Last night, it had been a huge concrete multi-storey car park. Rather than being square-sided, the edges of each floor had a sawtooth pattern as the parking bays had, for no good reason that I could see, been organised so that they were at 45 degrees to the parallel. This meant that drivers going into an edge space would be briefly heading out into the void with nothing in their windscreen but sky. I hated the fact that A, I remembered this, B, it seemed important, and C, it annoyed me that the planners of my dream car park had chosen to make it so stupidly. My dream car park. There was an annoying arrangement of words. The use of dream to indicate a desired thing or state of affairs would always be the meaning taking for comic effect if I tried to tell people about this. "Oh, you dream of car parks, do you, Bill? Did you hear that, Susan? Bill's got a dream of owning a car park one day." And never, ever tell anyone they appeared in one of your dreams. The Sawtooth car park was enormous, and very few cars were parked in it. The scale of it seemed designed to make users feel small, intimidated, and lost. In the dream, I wondered why I was there. The sky that I could see was the same colour as the walls. There were large puddles of stagnant water covering several parking spaces towards the centre of the floor. I urgently wanted to leave, and the doors to a staircase appeared. I knew I'd regret it, but I headed towards them. The doors had small glass panels at the top, obscured a little by the grid of wire within it and the grime from exhausts and weary hands. Approaching, I thought I saw a woman behind the door, standing with a large pot. As I got closer, there was a smell of something acrid. I'd never had a dream that featured a smell before. In the previous night's dream, I'd stood in a brick car park attached to a supermarket. My car was there. I appeared to have parked in a circular bay, where the parking spaces were set like the segments of an orange, on a suspiciously quiet end of the ground floor. The atmosphere told me that I was in danger of being mugged, or worse. The brick of the supermarket had now become the red sandstone of Dumfries Prison, and cars seemed to be heading towards a ramp to higher levels as quickly as they could. I felt panicked into joining them, but for whatever reason, I didn't drive but jogged up the ramp. On the next level, there was a series of doors that entered the supermarket slash prison. To get to it, I needed to climb a ramp of such a steep incline that the only way to scale it was by crawling on my hands and knees. Later when I woke, I pondered the significance of this struggle. But in the dream, I simply wondered how cars could manage to get up such an incline. My practicality in dreams was a source of embarrassment. As I crawled, I could see painted lines on the ramp. I knew they would make letters, but they were too big to see this close. I crawled on, following the curl of one letter. As I approached the end of what I was now sure was a large letter C, I could see the head of a man who appeared to be sitting in a hole. Cars carefully drove over him. The man, seemingly oblivious, whistled. I drew sketches of all the car parks I could remember in my bedside book on the page next to the written description and thoughts. On the front of the book, I'd written, "Is this it?"